Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, Brendan Wilson. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, the podcast where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about their creative process. My name is Edward Willett. I am myself an author of science fiction and fantasy. My most recent books include the World Shapers series from Daw Books, the upcoming humorous space opera The Tangled Stars, which will be out from Daw next year. Recently, the young adult fantasy Blue Fire, written under my pseudonym E.C. Blake, and the young adult science fiction novel Star Song, written under my real name, Edward Willett. Both of those are out from Shadowpaw Press. The other exciting thing out from Shadowpaw Press, which is my own publishing company, is Shapers of Worlds. Two anthologies by that name, Shapers of Worlds and Shapers of Worlds Volume 2. Both of them were kickstarted, and the first one, Shapers of Worlds, which came out last year, features authors who were guests of my podcast during its first year. And then this year, I kickstarted Shapers of Worlds Volume 2. And as I record this, it has just come out on November 2nd. And it's available now in ebook and in paperback, trade paperback, and in hardcover. And it features new fiction from Kelly Armstrong, Marie Brennan, Helen Dale, Candace Jane Dorsey, Lisa Foyles, Susan Forrest, James Allen Gardner, Matthew Hughes, Heli Kennedy, Lisa Kester, Adria Laycraft, Ira Naiman, Garth Nix, Tim Pratt, Edward Savio, Brian Thomas Schmidt, Jeremy Zoll, and me, and preprints from Jeffrey A. Carver, Barbara Hambly, Nancy Kress, David D. Levine, S.M. Sterling, and Carrie Vaughn. It's 140,000 words of fiction, 24 stories in all, and I highly recommend it. You can find it everywhere, whatever bookstore you'd like to buy it from. You can either order it in if you want to get it from a bricks-and-mortar bookstore or order it online. And you can also get it directly from Shadowpaw Press at shadowpawpress.com. If you'd like a handy link where you can find many places to get it, there's a universal link at books2read.com. That's numeral 2, books2read.com/shapersofworlds2. And again, that's numeral 2. So books2read.com/shapersofworlds2. And if you'd like to check out the first book, again, you can find that at Shadowpaw Press and through any other bookstore. You can also use the universal link, books2read.com/shapersofworlds. Lot of great fiction from my guests in the first and second year, and I'm already working on Shapers of Worlds Volume 3. People like Cory Doctorow and Kat Rambo and James Morrow and Walter John Williams. Those are the ones, among the ones, who have already said they'll take part. Many more. So it's looking to be every bit as exciting as the last two Shapers of Worlds anthologies. But I'll be talking about that more as we go forward, because that will probably kickstart in March, based on what I did the last 2 years. Okay, well, I think that takes care of all the preliminary material. Just to mention that the World Shapers podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. And now let's get on to this episode's guest, Brendan Wilson. Following 25 years of military service as a U.S. Army Ranger and paratrooper, Brendan Wilson retired as a lieutenant colonel. We'd say lieutenant colonel in Canada, but I'll say lieutenant. And then joined NATO, where he served as a defense planner and diplomat for the next 15 years. During the course of his 40 years of work as a soldier and diplomat, he saw service in war-torn Libya, Ukraine, Kosovo, Bosnia, and Iraq. A former coach and team captain for a military martial arts competition team, he holds master ranking 8th Dan in 3 different martial arts and won the silver medal in the 2009 U.S. Open for Taekwondo. In retirement, Brendan turned his efforts to filmmaking. He wrote and produced 2 award-winning short films, Doug's Christmas and A Child Lies Here, and served as executive producer for 10 episodes of the award-winning web series Greetings from Prison, starring Saturday Night Live's Chris Redd. Moved by seeing human lives upended in war-torn areas, Wilson is earning his law degree and, once qualified as an attorney, plans to volunteer to help refugees. A former assistant professor who taught military history at the University of Colorado, Wilson holds a PhD in international relations and has about a dozen publications on defense-related topics. He's the father of 2 adult children. Now lives a quiet life in Sycamore, Illinois, and spends his days writing, hiking, studying law, and practicing his martial arts. So, Brendan, welcome to the World Shapers.
Well, thank you so much, Ed. First of all, let me say what an honor it is that you've invited me to be on your show. I did some research on you. I realized that you're a very accomplished writer, and I am a beginner. So it's a real honor to be here.
Well, first of all, I read your bio, and then when I read a bit of the, I confess I wasn't able to finish the book because of time constraints, but I enjoyed the reading of it, and I certainly intend to finish reading it, and I look forward to reading the other books, I hope, in the trilogy as well. So,
Thank you. And
you know, you are the first person I've had who has a foreword from General Wesley Clark in his book, and there's some interesting things going on there. Now, I do like to find connections. It's difficult with you. I jumped out of an airplane once. Does that? I guess that's kind of a connection.
It does.
That's about it. military in our family, we do have some. Like my nephew spent 20 years in the U.S. Navy and served on the Harry S. He was in Kosovo as a prison guard, okay. I think. But that's kind of the closest I come to a military connection, I'm afraid. But welcome to the World Shapers, as I said. And we're actually going to talk mostly about your writing, but about your new book, The Achilles Battle Fleet, Book 1 in the Mei Ling Li Trilogy. So first, let me talk about your biography a little bit. I read quite a bit of it there, but where did you grow up and how did you end up going into all the things that you did? And where along there did you get interested in writing and science fiction in particular?
Well, thank you so much. So I was born in Virginia. My father was in the Army. We moved around a lot, overseas in different places. I ended up going back to Virginia for high school and college. And when I was in college, I wanted to go to law school. And one of my very dear friends had encouraged me to join the Army ROTC program because supposedly the Army would pay for my law school. Actually, I just kind of got interested in the combat arms aspect of the Army. And I ended up doing my career as a field artillery officer. As my bio says, I went to Ranger School, jump school, served in the 101st Airborne Division. When I was getting ready to retire in 2004, I was serving at NATO headquarters as a military officer in the international military staff. And I applied for a job over on the international staff side, which is the diplomatic civilian side. And I got a job there as a defense planner, where those are the jobs that were pretty much reserved for former military personnel because of the skills involved. And I did that for 15 years. You know, as far as writing goes, of course, I did professional writings as a military officer and as a diplomat. I wrote a couple short stories. And those short stories eventually were made into short films. That's Doug's Christmas and A Child Lies Here. And then, you know, when I retired in 2019, actually came back to the United States in 2018 for medical treatment, having been overseas and been in Iraq quite a bit, and I decided to retire the next year, I wanted to finish my law school. And I also wanted to finish my novel, which I had been writing for about 10 years. And it was in reasonably good shape, but it needed to be revised. And I know you'll probably talk to me a little bit about
that. Yes, I will.
And then we just now got it released. As far as my interest in science fiction, of course, you know, I had read Ineland's Starship Trooper, his Space Cadet many, many years ago. I got interested in the area of quantum physics through reading In Search of Schrodinger's Cat by John Gribben many, many years ago. I actually read it on my way to join the Army years ago, and I was having to stay in a hotel room before I reported, and I just picked up that book, and I thought, I don't know anything about this. I've been to college, and no one has ever mentioned any of this, no science background whatsoever. So that was interesting to me. I hope that's sort of a good introductory answer to your fairly broad question.
Well, did you, like, were you a big reader as a kid, or did that all sort of come along later?
You know, I think I did an average amount of reading for when I was a child. When I was about 40, I got hold of, I was working on the international staff, so all of my colleagues were from NATO or mostly from NATO countries. And I tried to find a book from each one of their each one of their nations. So I'd read Cervantes. I had read Freud. I read a bunch of different things. And then I would go to them and I'd ask them, you know, what do you think about this? What's your take on this? What do you think of my take on it? Sometimes I'd write a paper about the book and ask them to reflect on that. So that kind of, you know, put me in the mind to reading a little bit more. I think I've just read an average amount. I listened to your interview before and I realized that, you know, you had said quite rightly that reading was an essential part of that.
I think it is, but you obviously were doing lots of reading of not just, I mean, obviously you're doing a lot of reading in your career and understanding how you use words and communicate. Communication is obviously a very important part of what you've done for your whole life, I would guess.
I think that's probably right. Thank you.
So we'll look then at the Achilles battle fleet. You said you've been writing it for 10 years. So let's start at the very beginning. What was the impetus for you to, not being somebody who had focused on writing fiction, obviously, what was the impetus for you to suddenly decide to write a novel?
I think that I didn't actually have a plan to write a novel. I had an idea in my head, sort of that scenario. As you read the prologue and the first chapter, there is an incident where you've got a convoy of starships and they come under attack, and you get to watch the characters as they respond to that attack. And that is something I had in my mind. One of the things, if you see in chapter one, where Bowman is awakened by an alert to report to the ready room, something has obviously happened. He feels a bump, a thump, which he knows isn't supposed to happen on a starship, and he realizes that there's something going on. That scene was actually taken from one of my own experiences. I wasn't on a starship, of course, but I was in Baghdad. We used to sleep in bunkers, and there was a public address system and a system designed to pick up incoming fire with radar. And we got the announcement, in incoming fire, take shelter. And then there was a thump in the distance. And although in my case, you know, we got the all clear in a few minutes and I went back to sleep. But I was thinking about that experience when I started to write that into the story. So my idea, I think what was happening with me was I had this thing in my head that just kind of wanted to get out. And it later became a novel. As the characters developed and the situation went forward, and at some point I realized that this is definitely going to be a novel, and I continued to write it. I never did what you had described in one of your podcasts of having an outline, a synopsis, and that you start to write from that, and then you divert because of the characters as they developed. I just did without the synopsis. I let the characters sort of write the story themselves.
That's called pantsing. Writing by the seat of your pants.
Okay.
as opposed to plotting. So you have plotters and pantsers is the way it's often.
Okay.
When I was doing transcripts of this, and I would use that term, the automated transcription software would hear pantser, and they invariably rendered it as panzer, like the German tanks.
Yeah, there we go.
So you're a panzer.
Yeah. At least I am now. Now, of course, I have to write a trilogy. I have to write the other two novels, so I'm going to have to become a little bit better as far as plot structure from the beginning.
Well, you were, you know, clearly busy during all this time. How was finding time to work on this? Was this something you sort of did in spare moments as you could grab them, or how did that work for you?
That's exactly what I did. When I worked at NATO, so I started it in 2011, and I was already retired from the Army and working at NATO as a defense planner. With diplomatic functions, lots of travel, lots of long hours. If you ever meet anybody that worked on the international staff, it's a 60-to-80-hour week is common. Working through Christmas holidays, it's a very, very demanding, busy job. And I wrote when I could, and sometimes I would be on a train going somewhere, and I would, you know, take out my iPhone and pull up the Word program and start writing. Sometimes I did write when I was in a bunker in Baghdad. I wrote whenever I could. And it took a while, you know, so it took a good 7 years for me to get that little bit up. And I think you had mentioned before something I agreed with. You had quoted Stephen King's memoir on writing, on the craft, and that is the difference between good writers and other writers is that good writers, you know, just don't give up. They it's continue
more,
to write.
More the difference between published writers and other writers.
There we go. Okay.
You could be a good writer and still give up. So.
Yes, that's true. There we go.
You said something that you wrote on your iPhone at times?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Just, I had to.
Just thumb typing?
With me. Yeah, I just pull up the document that I was working on. Or if I sometimes it would just be a chapter or part of a chapter on an iPhone and send it on.
I've never tried doing that. But I did have somebody on here, Peter V. Brett, I think, who wrote this called The Demon Cycle. This very big best-selling fantasy series. And he started his writing his on, I think it was the London Tube, on his phone. And
that sounds cool. I've been on the London Tube before, although I don't think I ever wrote on it. So.
I presume you also sometimes wrote on a laptop or something like that.
Yes,
so.
Of course. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Longhand? Did you ever, scribble notes when you didn't have any other way to write?
Yes, that's right.
Well, that would be
longhand. Yeah, I have to type it back up.
So you're basically feeling your way through the story. You've hadn't written a novel before. That would imply to me that when you got to the, how did you know you were done, first of all? And then what did you have to do to go back and start shaping all this, this kind of raw material?
Yeah, it's a good question. Again, listening, so much of what you had said sort of hit home when I was listening to your other interview, that sometimes you just know when the chapter is over and when you need to go from a different perspective. And I think most of that sort of just sort of happened. It seemed like that was the right thing to do. The way the plot actually works out is you've got the initial conflict. There's a lot of casualties and a lot of and people have to step up into new leadership positions. So you've got an older admiral, Jay Chambers, who takes command, even though he is sort of passed over. He's a little bit older. He's in an administrative job, but he knows what he needs to do. And he first does the response to the attack, and then later he puts together this convoy, which is supposed to be basically sort of a ragtag evacuation thing, and he designs it into a battle fleet. And he does that using the leadership techniques, which I learned from General Clark. I served with him in the mid 1990s, and watched him work. Where you select your subordinates, you develop them, you push them hard, you see who shines, you give clear guidance, you accept responsibility for the things that cannot be done because there's not enough time. And then when the time comes, you make the hard decisions. And I think, so as far as the plot goes, there's basically two major climaxes. There's an attempt to steal or capture an enemy vessel that has this superior technology. And then there's a final attempt to go to the heart of the enemy, to attack them where they have actually been planning these attacks against the Alliance. And then all of the things that happen with that. And then finally, there has to be some sort of aftermath. And the aftermath in this case is they return back to Earth. And because there has been a conspiracy that they've uncovered, and people don't like that, they are facing court-martial and other bad things. And that situation resolves itself in such a way that it leads itself open to some sort of follow-up. What's going to happen to the characters now? Some of the characters are missing. There's some unknowns. The conflict is still ongoing.
Where did you find the characters? I mean, maybe that's quite the right word, but how did you develop the characters? How did you know what characters you needed?
Okay, that fair enough. So the Mei Ling Li character, she is she's in her mid-20s. She's Asian, born in Hong Kong. She's a martial arts master. That's actually based on my ex-wife, Sonia Mei Ling Wilson, somebody I have a great respect for and still have a very good relationship with. But she was born in Hong Kong. She's a martial arts master. She's not in the Space Navy. She also works at NATO headquarters. And so I used that character because I had an example of somebody that had integrity, that was tough, that wasn't afraid to stand up for what was right. And I think that's where that character came from. The character for Admiral Chambers really has two parts to it. Jay Chambers is actually the name of one of my friends from high school and college and from the Army, Colonel Jay Chambers, now deceased. I had gotten permission from his wife, his widow, to use his name, and he was somebody that had inspired me. He became ill with ALS after having served in the first Gulf War, when so many soldiers were exposed to chemicals, and that disease was much higher in that population than others. And he died about the time I started to write this novel. And so I wanted to use his name as a way of honoring his memory. But the actual character himself is based more on what I saw from General Clark. And I'll just give you one little example. General Clark and I went into, well, I was with his team, small team, we went into Srebrenica in 1998. And if you'll recall, in Srebrenica, they had the massacre. 7,000 men and boys had been killed. And the Muslim families, so surviving Muslim families, had been driven out. General Clark wanted to visit that. He was the NATO commander at the time. He had been instrumental in negotiating the Dayton Peace Accord, which had put together the three governments as one body. And we went in, and General Clark was like to walk around. We didn't have a big army with us. We had a few security people, a few diplomatic people, a few communications people, and me. I was his public affairs officer. And so he's walking around the street, and up pulls a van full of journalists from the OSCE. And those journalists were from Muslim countries. And no Muslims had been in Srebrenica since the massacre. And the population, of course, they pick up on that. They're aware of it. They're a little bit nervous. They don't know what General Clark's doing there. And we decided to do a press conference on the street. So we did a little press conference on the street. And there's about four television cameras, about 20 journalists altogether. And General Clark is giving, you know, his little stand-up press conference. And his security people came up to me and said, our interpreter has told us that some of the men in the village have told the boys to pick up stones and throw it at him. And I said, well, what will you do? He said, we will just get between him and the stones and we'll leave. There's no reason to stop what he's doing. And while that was happening, an older man who I think was intoxicated got up on a small wall behind him and started to yell at him. And General Clark actually speaks Serbo-Croatian, so he would have understood what he was saying, but he turned to him, so now you've got four cameras on him and 20 journalists, and he says, tell this man to come down. And the man says, he's not coming down. And General Clark says, tell him if he doesn't come down, I won't talk to him. So he comes down, and General Clark does this motion where he puts his hands at about waist high, palms upward, and he says, what can I do for you? And the guy gets down on his knees, he grabs General Clark's hands, he starts to cry, and he says, we're afraid that you're going to make us leave our homes. And General Clark said, did you vote in the last election? And he says, no. And General Clark says, this is your country. You need to vote. If you want to stay in your homes, you need to make sure your voice is heard. And the boys dropped the stones, and that situation was resolved. Mm. That's just one example of, you know, leadership, I think, and integrity that I saw through General Clark. And I reached out to him and asked him if he would write the foreword, and, you know, and he did, as you saw. He also did the audio portion of the foreword for the audiobook. Oh, cool. Which is about to be released here, the next thing. So he was the example of someone who keeps his cool under difficult situations, who has integrity that everybody picks up on. And I wanted that character, Admiral Chambers, to reflect those qualities.
So besides those characters, I would think that the whole book must reflect your experience as a military man. Have you read any other military science fiction, and do you find that they get the military stuff right?
Well, of course, anybody that's writing, you know, you're trying to communicate something to the audience. It doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be in every single detail what they experience, because people's experience is different. So, you can see when you read the book that I'm sort of drawing a little bit on Star Trek, a little bit on, you know, Star Wars, a little bit on Starship Trooper. I mean, there's all, you know, we've sort of incorporated some of the science that is already, that's already out there. But I did draw on some of my experience. For example, in the book, I was a U.S. Army Ranger, and I did some operations with the Rangers. And if you ever as an outside observer, one time I was in a big training exercise. I was commanding a firebase, and we got overrun. And the it was at a special operations rotation at the Joint Readiness Training Center, and the Rangers sent a team in to help us. And if you ever watch a real special operations unit move through a position, they move very fast. There's no wasted motion. There's no wasted shots. They do exactly what they're supposed to do, and they do it very, very quickly. And in the book, I actually have an example where somebody sees that during one of the things. They actually watch that. And I do think whatever, you know, experience that you've had, the veterans who have either served in the special operations or seen them will relate to that type of experience.
Well, it's that kind of expertise that I remember. I was on a panel once, and they were talking about it was with people who specialize in sword combat and that sort of thing, and they were talking about writing those kinds of action scenes. And what I think my only contribution was, I have no idea why I was on that panel. My contribution was, if you can't be accurate, be vague. So don't try to give a very detailed explanation unless you've really done your research and you really know what you're talking about or experienced it. Now, on the martial arts side, you're also a martial artist, and your character here, based on your ex-wife, is a martial artist. How do the martial arts figure into space combat?
Well, in this case, let me give you an example of where I had taken my experience and put it into the book. When I was at Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe, in Belgium, which is where I worked for General Clark.
I've actually been there, believe it or not.
Is that right?
At the outside, wow. You know, at least I've seen it.
Yeah, that's great. Anyway, so I was a public affairs officer at the time. And when General Clark would go to a different country, there would always be an advance party. Somebody would go in, and I would often go with the advance party. And the advance party is always run by the security people. And so one of the things that, because the NATO commander is also the commander of U.S. forces in Europe, so he's dual-hatted, and he is in the chain of command from the president to the secretary of defense, to the forces. So he is always protected. Partly because there's a nuclear chain of command that he is responsible for. So he's always protected. So he has security 24/7. It's very important. So when he travels, every detail of his trip is covered by somebody who is a security expert. So they'll go over the routes. They'll go over the hotel rooms. They'll go over where he eats. They also have to have places for him to go to in the event that someone needs to talk to him, some important person like the president. And he's the secure communication. So if he's traveling from point A to point B, there will be a house somewhere that is prepared for him to take a secure message. It's already been set up. Anyway, so I traveled with the security guys, and one of the things they had told me was that they were worried that they needed to protect the SACUR in Europe, and in the United States there would be a situation where they would draw their firearms and use their firearms to protect him. But in Europe, the laws are different. They don't really have any special status there. They're not as protected, and the gun laws are much, much more restrictive. So what they wanted to be able to do was to go through weapons disarming, so that if they see a weapon, they wanted to be able to take the weapon away from an assailant quickly without having to draw and fire their own weapons. And they had been going to Germany to see a martial arts instructor to do that. And I said, you don't need to go to Germany, because I could do that for you. I had a little school that I was running there at the base. So I trained their security people in these weapons disarming techniques. And one of the things you'll see Mei Ling Li do in the book is she trains the Marine Commandos in martial arts. So I sort of used a little bit of my experience to bleed over into that. But one of the things that I also wanted to bring out was, for example, there's a scene in the book where Mei Ling Li is challenged in the gymnasium by a very aggressive male who is trying to intimidate her. And she eventually squares off with him and spars with him and holds her own. My ex-wife, Sonia, was actually approached by someone who she worked with who wanted to sort of tease her a little bit. She was very petite. He wanted to tease her a little bit. He came up behind her. He's so over 6 foot tall. And he poked her with his finger. And she turned around very quickly and put him in a submission hold and said, "Can I help you?" And he said, "No, I'm good. I'm good." And then she sort of, twisted a little bit more and said, "Are you sure? I can't help you." He says, "No, I'm fine. I'm fine." And she said, "Please don't touch me without my permission." And she let him go. So, and she wasn't an aggressive person. I mean, Sonia is actually a very gentle, sweet person, but she doesn't really like to be touched without permission. And I like to see, people can stand up for themselves, not necessarily always in fighting, not necessarily in self-defense, but people should be, should have their dignity respected by others, and they should have the capability to make that clear to other people.
We've talked a little bit about technology. This is far future science fiction. How did you design the technology for your ships and for the world that you've set this in? I presume it's a couple of centuries at least in the future.
Yeah. Well, no, it's a good point. And I think, and I was listening to what you had said before, you have to find a balance between what are the rules. If you're too complicated, some people are going to be turned off. If you don't explain the rules, some people are going to be turned off. So you're looking to try to find the right balance there. So what I had developed was a series that's kind of like, it starts off sort of like what we would consider Star Trek. They have faster than light travel. They have vessels that can travel within the galaxy. They have, weapons and shields. They don't have transporter technology. And they don't have laser guns or anything like that. They use basically firearms, which are very similar to what we would have today. And what they experience is an unknown foe that apparently can make its vessels with pilots appear from nowhere without any warning and fight them. And so they're part of what they have to do during the course of the novel is to figure out that technology. And luckily, the head maintenance chief, Chief Petty Officer, is in fact a famous scientist unknown to them who has been hiding from the government for 20 years. And he comes to the fourth and says, "I think I know what this is." And what he tells them is that there is a mechanism for what we call macrowave collapse, which is we know that particles can travel as a wave, and that when they are observed, the wave function is said to collapse, and then the particle appears. So that's explained in reasonably quick terms. And what he says is that years ago they had been doing that on macroscopic objects, and that the government had stepped in and told them to stop working on it. And then at some point he had felt threatened, and so he'd gone into hiding and joined the Navy. And he didn't do anything in his field because he thought it would draw attention to himself, and he thought he would be killed. So what we then get to is, how do they actually do this? And the theory that I came up with was that looking at quantum field theory and the Higgs boson and the Higgs field, was this idea that they had somehow learned to bring the Higgs field, the quantum portion of the Higgs field, to zero value, which in my reading of it, my explanation of it, allowed them to not just travel at the speed of light with macroscopic objects like starships and so forth, but also allowed them to do that instantaneously. So that's kind of the theory that you get to. And it's only, and you talked about rules, the rules are, it takes a great deal of energy to do that, so it can't easily be hidden. And the second thing is, at great distances, there's no way to tell the relationships of objects. You literally have to be in the same frame of reference to use it, which means that they're going to have to put some sort of command and control ship away from the main base so that it's in the same frame of reference.
Interesting. And it must have been interesting then to work out the strategy and tactics that all these, the technological situation would allow your people to use.
Yeah, well, what they do is basically they do the tactics that they know. And that doesn't work perfectly. But they, as General Clark had said in his foreword, which is also written in the book, is no plan survives first contact with the enemy. Nothing ever works the way it's supposed to work, but still helps to have a plan.
I think that's the one quote that everybody knows about the military. So once you had this, the draft, What did your revision process look like? Did you bring in, you know, a lot of writers have like beta readers that will read things and make suggestions. Did you use anything like that? Did you just start at the beginning and rewrite it from start to finish, or how did that all work for you?
So the first thing I did was I tried to get an agent, and I sent out about 40 requests, and I would say about a third of them responded. They all said no, and so I knew that wasn't going to work. I reached out to some of the friends that I had made and colleagues that I had made with during the filmmaking. David Himmel, who runs a business called Illiterate Ape Publishing Service, he took that on, did the editing for me, has done the formatting for me, sort of served as the publisher for the book. For the audio version, I got Tommy Beardmore to recruit this very, very talented Harmony Zhang as the voice actor for the audio version, and that was a real experience for me. I'd never done anything like that. She happens to be a superstar. We were so very lucky because I couldn't have afforded her in a few years. I think she just graduated from DePaul's drama school with the MFA, and she did a wonderful job. I mean, you know, there's some scenes in there where there's a dozen speakers. They're, you know, they have different accents, they have different ages, different genders, and it's just a masterful job. I don't think the reader will even notice how good it is because it just comes across so clearly. So I did get some help on that. I did, and I didn't rewrite the whole thing. One of the things which came up is on the audio version, inconsistencies would become clear that weren't clear in the text.
Yeah.
And Harmony was great at that. Sometimes, you know, she would come back and say, this doesn't work. And sometimes she would just correct it because it was a mistake. And we would end up having to go back to and look at the text to make sure that the text was in line.
One of the best ways to vet your own text is to read it out loud, because it, yep. When you're just reading silently, your brain will see things that aren't there or skip over things, put in words that are actually missing, but your brain doesn't notice they're missing. But when you read it out loud, you can't skip that stuff.
Yeah, and nothing's better than having someone else read it out loud. So.
Yeah.
At least for me.
Yeah. Well, I have this anthology that I kickstarted. I've done two of them. The second one is about to come out, featuring guests from this podcast from the second year now I'm up to. And I read it out loud to my wife, because I read to her while she's cooking, because our kitchen is too small for us to cook side by side. So,
yep. So I have one of those too.
So I've been reading the stories, and I found several typos there that I hadn't found any other way. So it was definitely worthwhile. How long is the book, total word count?
It's about 380 pages altogether. It takes about 10 and a half hours to read if you just play it on the audio version.
So that's fairly good size, average size, I would say, for a for a novel. Did you do a line by line revision at some point, where you went through and, you know, yourself and found things that weren't working, or fixed things that you? I'm just thinking, because of the way you did it, kind of letting the story tell itself. Yep. There had to have been a polishing pass that you did through it.
Yep. I think the polishing pass came from feedback from, you know, David serving as an editor and Harmony serving as the reader. And of course, I've reread the book over and over and over again. And that process took quite a while, more than a year of having done that. I don't think it was as disciplined the way you describe it as a line by line edit. I think I would read it and we'd find a problem. Let me just give an example. At one point I decided to rename some of the characters. And then when we went to do it, it turns out that in some conversation, the character's name comes back up again, and it hasn't been changed. That was an example of a mistake that I didn't catch on my own reading. It wasn't as disciplined as you described. And keep in mind, I'm brand new at this. Maybe when I have 60 books published the way you do, I'll be better at it. So.
Well, with the editing process, what were some of the things that the editor found and suggested needed to be fixed or changed?
You know, it's interesting. So, some of it was just questions that they raised that I didn't change. I decided to leave it in there. For example, in the book, one of the things that's in the book is how much what they go through to train. So you've got a number of different training scenarios. You've got the Alliance Marine Commandos who train over and over and over again. They never stop. They're never satisfied. And that's very common for special operations forces. If you ever come across them, they're always doing something: weapons, communications, fire and maneuver, over and over and over again. The second thing is leadership training. So one of the things that happens in the fleet is you take a young man who is a recent recruit, and they need to put together an intelligence thing. And he has the right academic background. He's smart. There's an interview with him that shows that he can think clearly. And he has to go through an abbreviated officer candidate school as a midshipman. And I put the reader into what he has to go through and the stresses that he feels as he's going through that type of training as he eventually starts to build his conflict. And one of the things which the editor wanted to do was saying, you know, why is this here? It doesn't seem to feed the story. And I'd said, yeah, well, you know, I'm the author, so I want to stay.
Yeah, ultimately you get to make the final call. Yes, and sometimes there are things that you just want in the story, and somebody else may not understand why it's there, but you still get to decide that you want it there. And
sure.
And usually, and quite often, readers appreciate that. So once you had the finished manuscript, you have some, you know, you have reviews here from General Clark, Lieutenant General Nikos Toskos, and Grandmaster George Petrata. So how did you go about gathering those reviews? Who did you share this with prior to publication?
So, of course, General Clark had the book because he wrote the foreword for
right.
it. And that that quote from him is actually pulled from the foreword. General Toskos is a very good friend of mine. When I was a lieutenant colonel and he was a colonel, we served on the international military staff together as defense planners when we were still in the military. And then I retired and went to the international staff, and he went back to Greece, and he rose to the rank of lieutenant colonel, lieutenant general. Just a wonderful guy, a very humane person with a really good feel for Greek history and military history. And one of the things that we did in the martial arts was we developed a martial art of our own. It's based on Taekwondo. It's called Aristos, and it's based on the philosophy of classical Greece. And he served as an advisor to that effort. We made a film, a training film and a documentary in Greece that he served as an advisor for. He's also a really good friend of mine. He later, after his military service, served as the Deputy Minister of Defense. And then he served as the Minister for Refugees during the big refugee crisis in Greece. And so I reached out to him. I sent him a copy of the book, and I asked him for a comment, which he gave. Mr. Petrota is the Grandmaster for one of the martial arts organizations that I'm a member of. He is a wonderful guy, a great mentor to me, somebody who's quite prominent in the martial arts field as a Grandmaster. And I sent him the book, and he was kind enough to provide that comment.
You mentioned that you created your own martial arts discipline. Is that what you use in the book for the characters?
Yes. So although it's only mentioned in brief, of course, Mei Ling comes from a Chinese martial arts thing, but it's stated that her father is the founder of a martial arts thing. We don't use the term Aristos. Some of the approaches that that Mei Ling uses are drawn from our martial arts. For example, we have a term called agon, which is the Greek word for struggle. It's where we get the English word for agony. And it basically means it's sort of in place of perseverance. It means that there's a time to do the hard thing. And Mei Ling, you know, recalls that as she's struggling through what she's going through. There's also some mention in her training technique of how she develops her power and her focus and her training. That is also drawn from Aristos.
Interesting. Then what? Okay, this is because you're a brand new author, and people probably did not think of you as a writer. Were people surprised when you said you had written a novel?
I think people have been very supportive. My wife and I went to our 45th high school reunion right as the book was being published. And the people that were putting together the reunion allowed me to put the book up on the website. And so I got lots of people asking about it and so forth. We took a bunch of copies with us. And, you know, of course, you give out. I've probably given out 30 or 40 copies to different people that said they were interested, either from that or locally. We're looking to try to spread the word because we realize the first book is probably not going to make $1 million. But we're hoping that it will be an investment in future books and that more people will be interested in reading it. But people have been very, very supportive about it and enthusiastic, and they said nice things about it. One of the really good feedback I got was I sent a copy to Carol Chambers, who is Jay Chambers' widow, and she was just so nice. She sent a really heartfelt message back that she was really honored that I had thought to use Jay's name for that. And of course, she knew that was going to happen because I'd asked her for the permission, you know, 10 years before. And that was nice to get some good feedback. His oldest son actually wrote me a nice note to thanking me for that. So I think I've gotten some really good feedback from that respect.
Have you had feedback now from just general readers?
People? I haven't. Nobody has written a review. Please feel free to write a nice review for me, by the way. No, on Amazon.
Anybody listening? So
I know that's coming. And there will probably be some negative things in there. That's fine too. We need to learn. We need to grow, and people should be free to express their opinion on the book. I actually think it's a great book, to tell you the truth, and I think people are going to like it, and I think more people will like it and get something of it that they wouldn't otherwise that they might be able to take something out of it for themselves.
What would you like readers to take out of it? What do you hope is the response from readers to this story? This is called The World Shapers, and I sometimes talk about
that's right.
Can fiction shape the world in some way? And if not the world, then at least individual readers.
Yeah. Well, I thought one of the nicest things I did read about it was that quote that General Clark had made, and I pulled it out and put it on the back of the book. And he wrote, "Readers will take from Brendan's novel an understanding that individuals make a difference, that character counts, and with courage and competence, history is made." And I thought that was right on point, because what really matters to me, what I was trying to bring out, was to put these people in positions where they have to react to a very demanding situation. They have to make decisions of which there is no good alternative. All the decisions have negative consequences. There's no perfect. It's not like, oh, yeah, I got the answer and now we're fine. And military people have to make those decisions, and those decisions sometimes have deadly consequences for their own people and for their adversaries and sometimes for civilians. And the question for me is, what happens when they make those decisions? What happens to their personality? How do they develop? How do they think of themselves after they've had to do some very, very difficult things? And I think General Clark picked up on that his foreword isn't really about science fiction. It's about leadership. It's about character. It's about integrity. And that's what I wanted to bring out. And I think that anyone reading the book, you don't have to be a military person or a martial artist or even be interested in science fiction. The average person, the mother who has to make decisions on how to raise their kids, how to handle their budget, how to handle the difficult people in his or her life, that those decisions have consequences, and we need to own those consequences, learn from them, and move forward.
Now, that kind of gets into my big philosophical questions, the first one of which is, why do you write? And I think you're kind of just telling me that then, at least why you wrote this book.
Yeah, I think why I write is there's a story that wants to get out. It's like there's an idea in my head and it doesn't really come into focus for me unless I articulate it in writing. And then once that process is started, I mean, that's the process to get you started. The thing to me is, people are interesting. People are complicated. And I think I did another interview with Whistlekick Martial Arts, and he had said, I think some of the things you've told me are contradicting each other. And I said, I think you're right. You know, welcome to my world. You know, just like everybody else on the planet, you know, I'm complicated.
Well, one of the great things in fiction is that you can argue out your own contradictions through characters who have differing worldviews. They may be worldviews that you have thought about. Maybe you don't really hold them, but at least maybe you hold some aspects of them and you don't really have it figured out yourself. You can have your characters demonstrate and argue out these things that you're trying to figure out yourself.
You know, that's better stated than I was, you know, I was thinking that and you said it better than I was thinking. Thank you for clarifying.
Well, that's why I'm the host.
There we go. So
then the second big philosophical question is, why do you think any of us write? Why do you think human beings tell stories? What drives that?
You know, I was actually pretty inspired on listening to your thing where you'd started in the 80s to write. And you studied journalism, you did some of that, and then you started to write novels, and you wrote your first novel in the early 1980s and didn't get your first novel published until late 1990s.
It's the Stephen King quote, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that people have a passion for writing, and it probably comes from different sources for different peoples, but once they've set that course, they're gonna do that. And I think you're probably the best example that I know of somebody who's just stuck with it for decades and then was finally successful with it.
Decades and decades and decades. And then the other question then, of course, is why did you choose to make it a science fiction story? I mean, you have all this vast experience in all sorts of interesting areas. You could easily have written a present day story or a thriller of some sort. But you chose to put it into the far future and give it this science fiction edge. Why that choice for you? And why do you think, why does science fiction exist?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, to me, I was looking for a place to write my story. You know, as I told you, the beginning of the story comes from my experience in Baghdad. And one of the things that was happening in Baghdad was... I was an advisor to the Iraqi military, and I would have to go out from the embassy during the day and visit different, you know, military in different places. And at that time, it was a difficult time. Baghdad had 16,000 people a year killed through terrorism or other types of violence. That was just in Baghdad, where there was no actual military fighting. That's just the chaos that was surrounding that situation. I had really, really good close protection teams that were provided for me. So I wasn't doing some of the hard things that many, many of my colleagues were doing. I didn't spend years kicking down doors and getting shot at in the open. But it did have an effect on me. And I was thinking of, crisis and fear. And the fear of physical harm and death. And I wanted to write that into a story. And science fiction just happened to be the form for that. I did have an interest, as I said before, in developing quantum physics. And I did kind of want to get that into there. And I'm afraid that's probably the best answer I can give you.
That seems like a good answer to me. And now we've talked about what you're working on, I guess, which is continuing the trilogy. As you said, are you perhaps having to do a bit more planning and outlining up front than you did for the first one, now that you've got the first one out there and you know where you're going with it?
Well, I have to make a confession in that one of the things I'm doing in parallel is studying for law, right?
Right.
So I'm in my final year of my law program. When I decided to, I did my first year of law school while I was still in the Army, and I finished it in December of 2001. And at the time, of course, in September of 2001 was the attack on the United States at 9/11. I happened to fall into the role as the counterterrorism policy officer at NATO headquarters. And so I was able to finish the first year, but then, you know, our world just got busy, and we went directly into very, very busy time. And then when I retired, I worked, you know, as a civilian defense planner at NATO, and there wasn't a time. I tried several times to pick up the study of law, just couldn't do it. So when I retired, I thought, okay, I'm going to pick it up again. So I called the State Bar in California, which is where I was, the school that I had been doing my studying 17 years prior. And they said, you can come out to California and take what's called a first-year law student's exam. It's required for you to continue. So I studied, and I went out and did a prep course, and I went out to California, and I passed that exam. And I was very happy for that because it has about a 20% pass rate. And I thought, I'm ready to finish this off. 3 more years, and I'll be done. And it turned out to be way harder than I thought it was going to be. So my hat's off to anybody who's actually finished law school. I should finish in May. It has been all-consuming. I really haven't been able to do as much writing as I would like to. As you finish the novel, Ed, you'll see that at the very end, Mei Ling Li is court-martialed. So maybe some of my legal training will have played a role in that. So I haven't been able to do as much as I in May when I finish. I'm going to have to really get busy with the second novel, and I will probably have to do some of the what you talked about, which is to do a synopsis, to outline it, with the understanding that the thing will go where it goes.
But at least now you know the characters, you have them well developed, and that should help with the figuring out the rest of the story arc.
There are some plot lines that demand to be resolved in the second novel, that's for sure.
There's always loose threads. Even if you write a standalone, there are loose threads that can be picked up and turned into a sequel. I've done it a couple of times now where somebody said, would you write a sequel to this? Well, I wasn't thinking of a sequel, but sure, I'll pull on this little thread. And next thing you know, you got another book. So,
I think so, too. Some of the characters I developed, I think, sort of lend themselves to sequels in their own right.
Now, where can people find you online?
Okay. Well, first of all, they can buy the book on Amazon. They can either look me up under Brendan Wilson, or they can go to the Achilles Battle Fleet. I have a website at brendanwilsonwrites.com.
We should mention it's Brendan A-N.
Yes, B-R-E-N-D-A-N, brendanwilsonwrites.com. And that gives a little bit of background information. There's also some information about Harmony Zhang, who is the voice actor for that. Again, believe me, I will say this with confidence. People are going to like the audio version when it's out. It should be out here shortly.
No social media or anything like that?
I have a Facebook. People are free to contact me on that. I do have, for example, I do have a publicist working on this, Natasha Beardmore. She's had me do about 15 different interviews. Some of them were with blogs. Yours is the second one that was a podcast. I think we have about a dozen more scheduled. So those things will pop up at some point. And people could follow me there. I suppose they could just search for my name.
That's always works. Yeah. Well, I think that'll bring us to the end of this podcast. So thanks so much for that. I hope you enjoyed the chat. I certainly did.
Ed, thank you so much for having me. I really did enjoy it, and it's a great honor to have been on the show. And also, I consider you as someone to look up to.
Oh, well.
And I will be. I don't think I'm ever going to get 60. I don't think I have enough life left in me to get 60 novels published. But I'm going to get 2 more.
Yeah, well, you were doing other things, so when I was doing all of that writing. So, well, thanks so much for being on. And thanks again to Brendan for that great conversation. I really enjoyed that. Quite a fascinating guy with an amazing background. And the book looks wonderful as well. That brings us to the end of this episode of The World Shapers. Just a few reminders, of course, about where you can find things. You can find The World Shapers online at theworldshapers.com. You can find it on Twitter at The World Shapers. And you can find it on Facebook at The World Shapers. You can find me online at edwardwillett.com, 2 T's on Willett, W-I-L-L-E-T-T. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett, and you can find me on Facebook at edward.willett, and on Instagram at edwardwillettauthor, because, as I often say, I missed the memo where you're supposed to have the same handle for everything. Shadowpaw Press, which has published the anthologies Shapers of Worlds and Shapers of Worlds Volume 2, featuring authors who were guests of this podcast, is at shadowpawpress.com. You can find it on Twitter at Shadowpaw Press and on Facebook at Shadowpaw Press. And that kind of covers it off, I think. just a reminder that there are many more great guests coming up. In fact, this very next week, as I record this, I will be interviewing Mercedes Lackey, the latest Grandmaster from the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. Looking forward to that very much. And Michael Brent Collings as well. So there's two major authors I'll be talking to in the very near future. And there are several others that I will be speaking to pretty soon as well for future episodes. And finally, I do have to remind you that the World Shapers podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network.
The Saskatchewan Podcast Network is supported by Direct West. Is marketing getting in the way of running your business? Direct West has a local expert team right here in Saskatchewan that will work with you to build your website exactly how you imagine it. Let them help you improve your online presence and head to directwest.com to learn more.
There you go. Head to directwest.com to learn more, or head to any of those websites I mentioned earlier to learn more about me, Shadowpaw Press, and this podcast. That really is the end of this episode of The World Shapers. I hope that you will continue to come back and listen to many more as I go forward and interview more wonderful authors. And also, of course, if you go to theworldshapers.com, you can find every past episode. Many of them even have full transcripts. I stopped doing that because of time constraints, but many of them do have full transcripts for the first couple of years at least. And all of them have the full recordings available for you to listen to. That's it for this time. I will talk to you again soon. Bye for now.